Mother's Day. Good morning, everyone. And as always, thank you all for coming to start off the week with Dibrei Torah. The topic of today's shiur is a topic which is central to Parshas Pekudei. In the Parsha yesterday, the Torah discussed the completion, the building of the Mishkan, all the donations, all the items that were brought by the Jewish people. And the Torah goes to lengths to clarify exactly how much was given, how much of this, how much of that, the various items that were donated. So the Ralbag tells us in his commentary on the Chumash, other Rishonim say this as well, that from this we learn out a very important thing. The reason why the Torah goes to lengths to clarify exactly how much was given was to teach a lesson that a person who heads an organization, whether it's stuck organization or whatever it is should be held accountable and should make a point of giving detailed clarity of where the money went, what exactly it was used for, so that there should not be chashat, so that there should not be suspicion that the person, perhaps, some of the money was siphoned off somewhere else, or some activity was done with the money that wasn't correct. So therefore we are told that even someone like Moshe Rabbeinu, who was the greatest of them all, nevertheless felt that he had to give an accounting to the people of where exactly what everything came in, where it went. And from this we learn out the idea that one is supposed to go to lengths to remove chashat, to remove suspicion. And this is a topic which comes up in our lives today in two different areas, and that's what I'd like to speak about this morning. Basically, there are, if you ask somebody, let's say I want to go into McDonald's to get a soda. So what would be involved in that? So you'll say, some people will say, it doesn't look good. People say it's Marasayan. It doesn't look good. Which again is interpreted to mean that it's not the right thing, that it looks like you're doing something wrong. In reality, there are two separate issues in halacha which often get confused. One of them is similar but not identical. One of them is called chashad. Chashad means that I have an obligation that people should not suspect that I'm doing something wrong. That's chashad. Then there's something else called marasayan. Marasayan, the way the postum explains it, means that people may think the thing that I'm doing, people may think that if I'm doing it, it must be allowed. In other words, when it comes to chashad applies in a situation where there's no question in anybody's mind that what's taking place is wrong, but somebody sees me doing it and suspects that I must be doing the wrong thing. So to that end, there is an inyan of removing chashad. Marasayan applies in cases where the halacha may not be clear to people. It may not be clear what the halacha is, and if somebody sees an upstanding Jew do something, they may come to think that, if he could do this, then something else is permitted, which is what I will get to both of these points today, Be'ez Hashem. The first, I apologize for the precarious state of my voice. I may have to sip some water. I have right here. I would just point out to remove any suspicion that I made a bracha before I started. So, but that would be an example. In other words, for somebody, you can't drink water without. You can't drink water without saying a bracha, but so nobody would say, all right, it's mutter, but a person has to try to remove chashad. Now, the basis for chashad is derived from a pasuk in the Torah we have here. This is the first source on page 1. The Torah tells us that when Moshe Rabbeinu was in Parshas Matos, when Moshe Rabbeinu was negotiating with the B'nai Gad and the B'nai Reuben, with the 2.5 tribes that wanted to stay on the other side of the Jordan River, so they said that a deal was made that this would be permitted if they would first come and fight on the west bank. The Jews had already conquered the east bank from the various countries, Sichon and Og, Moab. So therefore, but the east bank was settled, the west bank still needed to be conquered. So Moshe said that if you want this land here on the east bank of the Jordan River, you can have it only if you will come over with us to the west bank and fight there, what we call today Eretz Yisrael. So this was a deal that was made, a condition, and the pasuk says, "V'nichpasha ha'aretz l'fnei Hashem v'achar tashuvu," that you will conquer the land, and then you will be allowed to return home. "V'yisem nekiyim me'Hashem u'me'Yisrael," and at that point, you will be nekiyim, you will be clean from your responsibility to God and your responsibility to people. In other words, at that point, you will be clean. So the Chazal say that the direct meaning of the pasuk is that at this point you will have satisfied your responsibilities. So the Chazal say that from this pasuk you see something a little deeper, that the Yisem Nikim Me'Hashem U'Me'Yisrael teaches us that there is a need for a Jew to appear clean in the eyes of not just of Hashem, but in the eyes of people as well. Because Moshe didn't just say, V'yisem nekiyim me'Hashem, that you have kept your deal. But there's an inyan that it should also be me'Yisrael, that it should also be from the Jewish people. Meaning, say the Chazal, that a person has to always try to appear clean. If someone does something that leads to suspicious, someone will be suspicious of what I'm doing, so I have an obligation to tell them. We find this in the Navi, in Shmuel, in the beginning of the book of Shmuel, we find that Chana went to pray in the Mishkan, in the view of Eli the Kohen, and it says that Chana was moving her lips, but her tefillos were not audible, so the pasuk says, Vayachshaveha Eli v'shikora, that Eli thought she was a drunk. This was not the mode of prayer that usually a person would, you could hear what they were saying, or at least you would see that they were saying words. She was just moving her lips. So the pasuk says that Chana went and explained to Eli and said that no, you should not suspect me. I am not a drunk. I am not a person who came in here in a disrespectful manner. But rather, this is due to the fact that I have a very hard life. And she explained what her difficulties were, that she had been childless and so forth. So this is an example. The Gemara in Brachos tells us that this is an example of a person removing suspicion. That she could have theoretically just said, listen, who cares what he thinks? God knows the truth. Right? What's the difference? He's the Kohen Gadol. Eli was the Kohen Gadol. But Hashem knows, I don't have to impress anybody. Right? It's just between me and God. But nevertheless, the Gemara says it's not true. That a person has to say, it's true. Obviously, what Hashem thinks is what counts. But we have the responsibility that we have to also try to appear clean in the eyes of people. This is what we see from the story of Chana. Similarly, we find here on the sheet in the second source, the Mishnah Maseches Yuma tells us also about there were two families in the time of the second Beis Hamikdash. There were two families of Kohanim that the Chazal criticized because they didn't want to share their knowledge with other people. And one of them was the family of the Beis Garmu. The family of Beis Garmu were experts in making the Lechem Haponim. The Lechem Haponim, the showbread in the Mishkan, which took great skill to make. By the way, just to put in perspective, the Lechem Haponim were not chametz. The Lechem Haponim were matzah. Meaning, they'll say, what do you mean it was matzah? I've seen pictures of it that it was... So the answer is, because that's true. They, in the old times, they were able to bake a thicker matzah than we have today. We lost our expertise today at baking matzah, and that's why when comes Pesach, you have very, very thin matzahs that are baked. But the truth of the matter is, the Gemara says, the Maseches Pesachim, that it's ad tefach, that it was possible to have matzah that could be up to a tefach in thickness. And that makes it a lot easier to understand when you come to the Pesach Seder and you have the challenge of eating the korech, when you have to, you know, put the matzah and the morah together, and we recite there that in the time of the Beis HaMikdash they also put in a piece of the carbon Pesach, and it ends up getting all over your clothes and all over your kittel, and you say to yourself, well, whose idea was this? Right? This is Hillel, with all due respect, I mean, what was he thinking when he said to eat it like this? The answer is because in the time of the Beis HaMikdash it resembled a sandwich, because the matzah was thicker. We can't do it today. There are some that claim amongst the Sephardim, and it's a limited the people who say they know how to do it. I'm not, whatever, it could be they do, but most people don't rely on that. So therefore we make very, very thin matzah. But just, it's just as an aside, the lechem aponim in the Beis HaMikdash were matzah. They were not chametz. And there's matzah means not chametz. Matzah doesn't mean razor thin, right? But it took a great deal of skill to do this. So these people from the Beis Darmu did not want, they were experts, but they didn't want to tell anyone how to do it. So the Chachamim criticized them for this. Says the Gemara, it's a little bit hard to find. It's about halfway down the page, the Gemara says that even though they were criticized, they were also praised. The Gemara says, it's about two lines before the Tanur Rabbanan, but they were also praised, these people. Why? Because me'olam will nimtzes pas nekia biad b'neihem. Because they never, their children, their family members never walked around with beautiful white bread. They never had, when their kids went to school, they didn't take regular sandwiches with white bread, with nice looking bread, but rather they had other inferior quality bread that they used. Why was this? Because they didn't want anybody to suspect that the bread that they have is, you know, once we're making the lechem upon him, you know, so might as well put some of it, take some of it home also, put some of it in our pockets, you know, we'll go bake bread for the family. So they were praised for this. Says the Gemara, L'kayim ma'ashenemar v'yisem nekiyem me'ashem u'me'yisrael, that this was a fulfillment to the pasuk. A fulfillment to this pasuk that you should be clean in the eyes of not just Hashem, but also in the eyes of the Jewish people. They were praised for doing this. Similarly, further down on the page, the Gemara speaks about another family of Kohanim where the Beis Aftinas, Kohanim, were experts in making the Ketores. To make the Ketores required mixing together ingredients. It was not a simple thing. Right, we read that, you know, we have in the davening that you had to make it in such a manner, and it had to be mixed just the right way, and the smoke had to go straight up, etc. So the Beis Aftinas Kohanim knew how to do this, but also they didn't want to share it with other people. They wanted to be that we are the experts, and that's it. So the Gemara says, but they were praiseworthy in a different way. And that is, the Gemara says, Me'olam l'yotzes kala mevusemes mibeteim, that their daughters did not walk out wearing perfume. That their daughters did not, not only that, says the Gemara, but ukshenosim isha mimakom acher, that even at their weddings, that when they would marry someone, their daughters didn't wear perfume, and even if their sons married a girl from somewhere else, they would tell the girl in advance of the shidduch that you should just know that if this goes through, you can't wear perfume to the wedding. Why not? Says the Gemara, because of the fact so that they shouldn't say, people should not say, oh, where did they get this perfume from? It smells so nice. Where does it come from? It comes from the Ketores, because they have access to all these items. So therefore, they're able to mix together, so they can make, you know, it's not, obviously it doesn't smell, the, you know, probably didn't smell the same way that the Torah smelled, but the fact is that you know, maybe because we have the access to making the Ketores, so therefore we can make perfume for ourselves too, and take from the items of the Beis HaMikdash, so they didn't do it. Again, the Gemara says, L'kayim, this is a fulfillment of what it says, V'yisim nekiyim Hashem Yisrael, that a Jew should try to be clean in the eyes of not just God, but also in the eyes of others. And therefore, this applies in any such situation where a person has a you know, whatever the scenario may be, or a person is in a situation of leadership, or even not, but there's room to think that what they're doing is wrong. We have, if you turn over to the page here, to the second side here, page 2, on the we have a Mishnah Maseches Avodah Zarah that says, Ir sheyesh ba avodas kochavim, that if there is a city where there is a lot of idol worship going on, so there's a question, are you allowed to go into that city? Or, so that's the first part of the Mishnah. Then the Mishnah discusses, are you allowed to go on the road that leads to that city? So the Mishnah says, in the second line, Bizman shaderech miyuchedes lo samakom osur, that if this road only leads to this city, meaning that if this is the only way to get to the city, even though your intention is perhaps not to go to that city, but you're traveling on the road and people know this is the road, this is identified with the road of this city of Avodah Zarah, so the halacha is you're not allowed to go on that road because of the fact that people will see what you're doing and they will suspect. They will suspect that you're doing it because of Avodah Zarah. So this is the inyan of a person trying very much to remove chashad. Now, I just want to point out that even though this sort of flies in the face of one of the most basic principles in the Torah that we have, that you're supposed to judge people favorably. You're supposed to be dan l'kafschus, it's a mitzvah, that if you see a person doing something, you're supposed to judge them favorably. But nevertheless, as much as that is a great mitzvah, but unfortunately the reality of life is that oftentimes people don't do that. So therefore the Torah tells us that v'yisem nekiyim Yisrael, right? And this is just, you know, to put into perspective, every time we say the Birchas HaMazon, every time we bench, so towards the end we say a special tefillah, v'nimtza chen v'seichel tov be'enei Elokim v'odam, that we should find favor not just in the eyes of God, but that we should find favor in the eyes of people. Which means that we, not just that people should like us, but that people should not suspect us. We should not be viewed as suspicious, shady characters. And if a person is doing something that might give off that impression, even though he's doing it for the right reason, but he really should inform others and say, you should just know, this is what I'm doing, don't suspect me, I'm doing it for this reason, even though you'll say, well, he has no business suspecting me, and after all, I have a good reputation, and I'm a good person, but nevertheless, this is a chiyuv that we derive from this pasuk, that a person should always try to remove chashad. Now, the second area, which is what's more commonly known, is the area of marasayin. Marasayin. Okay, marasayin means, how is it going to appear to the observer? So people assume, well, that's the same thing as what we were just referring to. But in reality, it's not, because as many explain, marasayin runs a little bit worse, because marasayin is a scenario where somebody who sees that somebody may not be clear in the halacha, and they may think there's nothing wrong. And if they see you doing something, even though you're not doing what they think you're doing, but they may come to conclude that the thing that they're wondering about is mutter. What do I mean by this? Sounds a little confusing. So if you turn to page 4, we have a shaila was asked in the 1950s to Rav Moshe Feinstein, that they asked about, back in the day when conservative and reform Judaism dominated the American scene to the degree that there were many, that there were Jewish communities that did not have Orthodox shuls in them at all, but they had Orthodox people who did not want to daven with the, let's say, the reform minyan, or the conservative minyan. So what they arranged was that they spoke to the rabbi or the board of directors, whoever it was, and they got permission that they would be given a room in this shul, in this temple. They would be given a room that they could daven, that they could make an Orthodox minyan. So the question is, are you allowed to go in to the Reform temple or the conservative to go ahead and daven in an Orthodox minyan? So Rav Moshe Feinstein said that this would be prohibited because of Mara Sinai, because of the fact, he said it's actually two things. He says both. On the one hand, by some people it would be chashad, because people who know, because since this building is not known to house an Orthodox minyan, it's not known for that, right? This is a Reformed temple. So therefore, people are, when they see you going in, some people will say, well, what's he going in there for? So the people who know that you shouldn't daven like that will say he's going in to daven in the Reform minyan, which is not correct. And on the other hand, there are other people who don't necessarily know the lines weren't drawn so clearly. Is it so bad? A conservative shul, not as bad as Reform, right? So maybe it's not okay. They don't have a mechitza, but you know, if everything's said and done, maybe it's not so terrible. So people will say that if I see this fellow going in there, then it must be its mutter. Then it must be its mutter. That is Mara Sinai. In other words, chashad is where they're going to suspect that you're doing something wrong. Mara Zion is where they won't suspect that you're doing something wrong. They'll think you're doing the right thing, but they'll learn from that this is the right thing to do. In other words, they don't know that you're going into this place because they have a special room for an Orthodox minyan. Okay, so this is the concern that we find of Mara Zion. And this obviously applies to many situations. I remember years ago, so when I was learning in Kol in New York, so in New York you have a situation after Pesach that Baruch Hashem we don't really have to deal with over here, and that is that there are many supermarkets that are owned chains or individual stores that are owned by Jews that don't, you know, they're irreligious Jews and they don't sell their chametz before Pesach. So therefore they have chametz in the store on Pesach that they own. A Jew who owns chametz on Pesach, that chametz is prohibited even after Pesach. That's called chametz she'avra olav ha-Pesach. Chametz that was illegally held in the possession of a Jew on Pesach, you're not allowed to derive benefit from even after Pesach. So here, Baruch Hashem, I've never heard in any of the stores, not Publix, not Winn-Dixie, not any of the others, of any such problems because they're owned by Goyim. But in New York, in the New York metropolitan area, the problem is that the distributors, the food distributorship in New York is a heavily Jewish business, but mostly by irreligious Jews. So therefore there's a problem because you can go into the store to buy, it's a week after Pesach, you're going to go buy the cookies. But the thing is that those cookies were sitting in the Jew's warehouse on Pesach, which makes them prohibited. No Jew can derive benefit from them afterwards. So usually what goes on is that almost every shul on the last day of Pesach, the rabbi gets up with a list and says the following stores are good, and the following stores should be avoided for at least a couple of weeks. Usually it goes till around the time of Pesach Sheni, around that time, Lag Bomer. That usually that's the time. It's not based on any formula in halacha, it's just based on practically when they, you know, how quickly they move their merchandise. So so this is Chametz Shavuot HaPesach. So there was a store near the yeshiva that I was learning in that was a problem store because it was owned by Jews or it was supplied by Jews. So, but the store had very good prices. It was a chain. So they had very good prices, and that's where I used to shop to go into the smaller kosher stores. more expensive. So figuring that, you know, trying to be a little practical, so I used my Yiddish cup to determine that what I would do is I'll go into this chain store and buy non-chametz items. I'll go, in other words, right, but just because you can't buy the chametz items doesn't mean you can't buy the non-chametz items. Right, so go in there and buy stuff that isn't chametz. It won't be a problem. I'll get it at a cheaper price. And then the chametz items, the cookies, the bread, the pretzels, that'll have to go to the kosher store. That's what I was thinking. So I went in, I did a shopping, and I'm standing in the parking lot unloading my wagon into the trunk of my car, and a woman walks up to me and says, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." I said, "Who are you? I've never met you before." So she said, "Well, I'll tell you, it's after Pesach, and I don't know, I know there's an issue of what stores you can buy from and what stores you can't, but when I saw someone looking like you shopping in that store, so I knew right away that this must be a kosher, acceptable store," and sure enough, she shows me in her wagon loaded up with all kinds of chametz sticker things. So what was I going to say at that point? So I didn't know what to say, so I just wished her well and drove off. But I didn't really think, she didn't seem like she was ready to go back into the store and do all the returns. So I figured, just let it go, you know, based on what we once spoke about a different time, that, you know, if they're not, don't give someone mussar if they're not going to listen to you, and then they'll do it b'mezit. So I just let it go. But in a certain sense, you have to be careful in a situation like that. Because of the fact that that's a case, it wasn't chashad. That's not shad. The person didn't think I was doing the wrong thing. They thought I was doing the right thing. But they said, "Oh, very good. If that's the right thing to do, then I could do it. Then I could do it." It was not processed correctly. It was not interpreted correctly. So therefore, this is the situation of where we have of Maris Ayin. Okay. Now, it happens to be that we find in the halacha, in the Gemara, we find many situations that are too numerous to mention where there were things that were prohibited due to Maris Ayin because it could be misleading to people. A question that is discussed in the poskim, there is an opinion of one of the great Sfaradic Achronim, the Pri Chodesh, who wanted to say that when it comes to the prohibition of Maris Ayin, that you only go by what we find in the Gemara. We can't make our own. We can't make our own Maris Ayin. In other words, just because today something may be a problem, it's only if you find it in the Mishnah and the Gemara, that's when you have to be concerned, but if not, you don't have to be concerned. However, that you know, in which case, perhaps the supermarket that I went in, I didn't do the wrong thing, because what was so bad? You know, it doesn't say anywhere in the Gemara you can't do something like that. However, that we find, and if you turn back to page 2, we find that the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch disagrees with this ruling of the Pri Chodesh, and the Ramah says that a very interesting thing, that they used to use, apparently in the old days, they would use milk that from almonds, or like you have today, coconut milk, different things like that. They would use it to cook. They would use it for cooking purposes. And it has the whitish appearance of milk. It doesn't appear exactly like milk, but I guess close enough. So the question is, can you take that milk and cook it with meat? Right? Now the halacha is that it should be mutter, because the Torah only prohibits the milk of a cow or of any other kosher animal to be cooked with meat. Okay, so therefore, if it was milk from a coconut, right, it should not be a problem, right? Just because it's called milk doesn't make it prohibited. It's very specific in what it's referring to. But the question is, people may not understand. If somebody walks into your kitchen and says, "What in the world is going on? This person just poured a cup of milk into the chalent." Right, and I thought they were, you know, what is the story with this? So the Ramah paskins that now the truth is, we find in the Gemara that the Gemara says a similar issue comes up with the blood of fish. Okay, now we know that a person, Torah says, a person not allowed to eat blood. But when we say not allowed to eat blood, it only refers to the blood of an animal. Okay, in other words, or the blood of a bird, So therefore, when the shechita is done, they always do melicha, they have to salt the meat in order to get the blood out. However, there are other forms of blood that exist in the world that are not prohibited by the Torah, such as the blood of a fish, or, for that matter, the blood of a person. So, but nevertheless, there's a Gemara that tells us that a person, so, I mean, it's hard to understand how people would do this in our world, but apparently there was an interest to put out fish blood, that people should dip into it and use it for eating. Apparently in the old days this was considered, you know, something that was acceptable. You know, I guess today we eat sushi, so we have our own mishgas. But in every generation there were always things that you know, people had, this was considered a delicacy. So the Gemara says that this is, that a person should not do this without putting it, we should, to just put out a bowl of fish blood, a person should not do, because people won't know what it is. They'll say, well, if this is true, then blood is mutter. Then blood is mutter. So they will come to eat even the blood of an animal, which is prohibited. But that would be marasayan, because now they're going to derive from what they say, well, this person invited me. I know this person is very scrupulous in their observance of kashrus, and here they have blood on the table in this bowl. So it must be that blood is acceptable. So the halacha is that you're not allowed to do that, says the Gemara, unless you would put out some remnants of the fish. If you would put, like, right attached to the bowl, you know, right next to the bowl, some scales or anything for that matter that would indicate that it comes from a fish, so then it would be mutter. So this is found in the Gemara. Now, cooking meat with almond milk is not found in the Gemara. But yet the Ramah rules, based on that Gemara, that the same thing would be true, that you could not cook meat in the milk that comes from almonds, unless you put some of the almonds down on the table and right near this milk, so, or people see what you're doing. And people realize that this is not a real, that this would not be a marasayan. So this shaila comes up, obviously, in our time. The whole world, it has changed in terms of food. Today, you go, you have non-dairy creamer, and you have parva ice cream, and you have all kinds of things. So the question is, can you just serve it without saying anything? Or do you have to make an announcement? So this is a dispute amongst the contemporary poskim. The consensus opinion is that you don't have to say anything, because in our time, it's so known, it's so well known that you have these items, that if you went to a kiddush or you went to a wedding, and for dessert they had a dessert table, and they had what appeared to be milk in a container, and a little pitcher to put into your coffee, so everybody understands that this is para. It cannot be, it's not possible that, you know, this is, that this would really be, milk, because we know today, I know the person would be careful about it, and I know today it's so readily available. However, this was not always the case. My father, Shlomi Well, told me once that many, many years ago, about 50 years ago, he attended a conference of rabbis that was held in a hotel, and they served, this is in the 1950s, they served a very elaborate meal, and at the end of the meal, they served ice cream. Now, they had power of ice cream in those days, but my father, he ate the ice cream, and he said, this is the most incredible power of ice cream I ever tasted. In those days, they weren't as skilled as we are today. Today, you have the food, you have all these kinds of things. But in those days, it was primitive. The kosher market was primitive. So he said, my gosh, this is incredible. So he went into the kitchen to compliment the chef on this incredible power of ice cream. So he said, how did you make ice cream like this? So the person said, what are you talking about? That it's regular, this is Dolly Madison ice cream. So he said, how did that happen? So apparently the mashgiach, again, if you want to see, we've made progress over the years, the mashgiach went home after the main course. They did have power of ice cream, but they ran short. So there was across the street from a supermarket, they sent one of the guys across the street to get some. They didn't know, the people in the kitchen, the guy cooking in the kitchen, ice cream is ice cream. So this is what they serve. So in those days that you would have had probably to say something. But in our times today, so many poskim say that you don't have to. There are those that still do it. There are people that will put down, if you go to a simcha and you see that they put down the container of cream on the table, you should not say, oh, these people are classless. How do they go ahead and put the box on the table? That it could well be that they're doing it because there are those who say that it's preferable to do it. But the consensus, the great, great majority, Rav Avadi Yosef writes one of his tshuvas that today everybody knows. And the same thing, you have all kinds of parva gimmicks. You have parva, meat and parva, with chicken patties and all kinds of things like that. So if you go and you say, what, how could they serve this together with milk? And they let you know it's milk. So the answer is because it's not really fleshy. So today, there, on the one hand, there could be marasayim. On the other hand, there is the marasayim. In other words, we there are modern day situations of marasayim. But on the other hand, if it's known that it's not a problem, you don't have to worry. Now, the big question. Now, by the way, just a simple application of this would be that the person goes into Publix. So if you think about it, you could ask, just applying what we're discussing, how could any Jew go into Publix if, well, they sell non-kosher food in Publix? Right? So the answer is, okay, but there's no chashad. As far as, you always have to deal with these two considerations. Is there chashad? Is there marasayim? So chashad there isn't, because the person who sees me going into Publix says, well, they have plenty of kosher food. So this person obviously is not going in to buy the non-kosher, he's going to buy the kosher. And as far as marasayim, so again, because of the fact that they serve, that they sell their kosher food, so a person would not have the basis to assume that you're allowed to buy non-kosher food, because there are plenty of kosher food there. So therefore, in that case, there would be no question. Where the shaila comes up more is in two scenarios. One of them is going into a place that is clearly a not kosher establishment to buy something which is known not to be kosher, but sells some things which are kosher as well. For example, a non-kosher restaurant. So not everything in a non-kosher restaurant is not kosher. You can go in and get a soda that's kosher. You can go in and get an unflavored coffee that's kosher. You can get water, right? There are different things that you could get. So how do we view that? And this comes up a lot in today's world, where a person is invited to a business meeting and they want to hold it, or a party, an office party, and they're going to be serving non-kosher food. And the question is, am I allowed to go to such a party? Am I allowed to go into such a restaurant? If they want to have a meeting, and this is a non-kosher restaurant, so, you could say, well, anybody who sees it will say, I'm going in to get a soda. So here, there is a psak that we have, also Rav Moshe Feinstein's psak, which I think very much is the foundation of the halacha that is practiced today. Although from rav to rav, from rabbi to rabbi, you could get different opinions, but pretty much this is what he said. If you go to page 4, so on page 4, in the bottom, there are two sections there. In the bottom section, so again, he was asking the Shaila if you could go into a restaurant. He wasn't even talking where it's totally not kosher. He was talking about it was run by religious Jews, and you know that they sell non-kosher items. So he said that a person should not go into such a place because of both problems, because of marasayin and chashad. Okay, the chashad is because some people will say that, oh, he's going in there, it must be he's going to eat something which isn't kosher, it must be that because of the demand, for whatever reason, he's going to eat something that's, he's going to rationalize eating something which isn't kosher. On the other hand, you also have the consideration of marasayin, which is that some people may not realize that the things in there are not kosher. If they're serving pork, that's one thing. But maybe, let's say, in a non-kosher dairy type restaurant, you know, let's say a pizza type place or something like that, you know, where they're serving essentially machole cholok, where they're serving, you know, what we would call milchada food, you know, pasta, different things, but there's a lot of the oils they use aren't kosher and the cheese isn't kosher and all these kinds of things. So then it could be that it would be there's a marasayan there too, because people will say that if the Jew goes, that he's going in there, it must be that these things aren't problems. Today, in the kashrus industry, you know, years ago, if you recall back to the day, it used to be that rabbis, I remember this clearly, respected rabbanim would paskin questions on kashrus by reading ingredients of an item. It was commonplace because the kashrus organizations that we have today weren't nearly as developed as they are, so hechsherim was scarce. So therefore, a child would bring a candy into shul, and the father would say, go ask the rabbi, and the rabbi would look at the wrapper and say, bah, 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 bah. Nothing here is not kosher, it's fine, you can eat it. Now today, the world has changed. If you speak to people in the kashrus business, they will tell you that the reason why it's changed is because there are non-kosher ingredients that we don't identify. Because, you know, the things that you know what they are, you know, let's say, just for example, flour, sugar, salt, that we know. But then you get to the four-syllable words that they have printed in the ingredients, and there it is possible that they have ingredients that aren't actually non-kosher. Sometimes they have animal fats mixed in there, sometimes they have other non-kosher items, but it's not clear. When you read it, it's not clear what it is. So therefore, you say, well, this probably came from some lab, some, you know, chemicals, but not, that's not all that it is. So therefore, you can't really pass in chayos like that anymore. I'm not saying it was wrong years ago, but years ago it wasn't as complex. The food industry changed also. So today, by us, we can't do that. But not everyone knows. So if you go into, you know, people think, well, they don't serve, you know, Jews who aren't so knowledgeable will think, yeah, well, I wouldn't eat pig, but to go into a non-kosher dairy restaurant type of thing, what could be the problem? So therefore, there could be a shiloh of marasayim. So on that basis, he wanted to say you shouldn't be allowed to do it. However, he said that there could be mitigating circumstances. It could be extenuating circumstances. And he said, the one that he gave is very simple, simplistic type of thing, where he said that if a person is having a great deal of tsar, in other words, I'm very, very thirsty, and there's no place to get a drink except the McDonald's. There's no place around to get a drink. And I have a lot of time, very thirsty. So he said, since the prohibition of marasayin is an issur derabbanan, this is prohibited by the rabbis. It's not really the chashad is daraisa even there, but you know, you could argue, but marasayin is essentially derabbanan. So he applied the rule that the makom tsar lo gazru, that generally speaking, the rabbinic prohibitions are waived in a case of tsar. So therefore, not always, but often that's the case. So therefore, he wanted to say that if a person is very thirsty, they could go in on that basis to get a drink. So some want to say, and this shuva was written a long time ago, that then he proceeds to say that it's better, you know, that if you see someone who knows you outside, you should tell them what you're doing. But based on this, there are those who want to say that perhaps if it jeopardizes a person's parnasa, that could also be fit into that type of category. In other words, I have to go to the meeting. I have to be there. They will not accept an excuse if I don't come. You have to use judgment. You know, if it's just a question of you're courting a new client, you're not losing anything. Just you could be making more. Then it's less of a heter. But if it's a situation where I have to show up, I have to show up. If I don't come, I'm going to have big tsaras from them. So then it could be that there are people out there that there are rabbanim who say, extending this principle of a makom tsar lo gazru, that in the case of a very big loss, that it could also be that it would be permitted. So this really, it's hard to say for sure. This depends who you ask. You know, there are different rabbanim. A person should ask if the shaila came up. This would be the type of thing where it needs to be evaluated on a case by case basis. But sometimes you could have a situation where if something is known to sell only bad things, so then it becomes a problem. But other times it might not be. So for example, in other words, to go into a McDonald's in the city to buy a soda, so you can make the argument that you shouldn't do that because even though everyone knows they sell sodas there, but that's not what they're known, that's not what they're famous for. They're famous for things which aren't kosher. However, if a person is driving on the highway and they have a rest stop, and the rest stop usually they sell the state or whoever, you know, they negotiated the chain, and they have all the rest stops, they have their franchise. So in a situation, and you need to use the bathroom. So in a situation like that, when it's a rest stop on a highway, it's understood that people go in there for many reasons. People go in there to buy food. People also go in there to use the bathroom. So or people go in there because they have vending machines. They have vending machines in there. So then it would be okay. If you had a cafeteria that sells kosher and non-kosher food, but they also have vending machines, then you could eat there. You could go take, and you could even bring your own lunch and sit down and eat it, because of the fact that people will say that this is the type of place that's not limited for that situation. To walk into a restaurant with your own food, they won't let you. But to go into a rest stop, or to go into a similar type of place where they have an eating area, even though McDonald's controls it, but it's understood that they'll let you bring in your own, because they're servicing the travelers. So in a situation like that, there really is not a problem, Marisain. The honest truth is that a lot of judgment, it's hard to say for sure in every situation what's good and what's not. A lot of judgment is needed, and a lot of times you have to be very careful who's watching you. If you're in a place, if you're in the Montana, you know, your business somehow takes you where there's not a Jew within, who knows, 100 miles, so then you could go in there and there's no chat because nobody knows nobody's suspecting you of anything, they don't know anything. But if you're in a place, you know, a lot depends on the circumstances. There are people who claim that in a heavily Jewish area, people know more, and maybe here in Miami, people know more. In New York, they say that even to go into a non-kosher restaurant, but people understand that he's not going in there to eat because people are more familiar with the ins and outs of Yiddishkeit. You know, I was just this past Friday in Macy's, and as I was checking out, the cashier who had a cross hanging from her neck said to me, Shabbat Shalom. So in a situation like that, where people are more knowledgeable, it could be that it's better because they understand more. On the other hand, if there are people, more Jews around, it could be suspicious because there are people that don't know. And if they don't know and they see you doing something, they may learn from that it's mutter. So a lot of it has to go on a case-by-case basis. But this is just an overview of the two concepts of chashad and maris ayin.